Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council, brought to you with the generous support of Chevron. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. Tomorrow, Americans will head to the voting booth to elect the next president of the United States. And regardless of who wins, the new executive will face a country divided, as well as a backlog of problems to solve. This episode focuses on the challenges that the next president will face on day one of his or her administration. In this hour, we'll hear from Anne Marie Slaughter. She's president and CEO of New America and served in the State Department as director of policy planning. We'll also hear from former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson. He's chairman of the Paulson Institute. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. For the first half of this program, I sat down with Anne Marie Slaughter. Now to our conversation.
We're about to turn 70. Not Peter and me, but the World Affairs Council are about to turn 70. And we're facing a very different world than we did 70 years ago. But interestingly, here we are in 2016. A new president will be coming in January and facing a very divided country. And an awful lot of problems that await in that in-basket. And I think Anne-Marie would agree that those problems can't be solved by a president alone, but they will be in the next president's lap. Anne-Marie Slaughter is the CEO of New America, which is a think tank that's based in Washington, D.C., but has some great friends here in the Bay Area and in Silicon Valley. Before taking on that role of leading that organization, she was director of policy planning in the State Department. And as you all know, that's the sort of think tank part. So that's the deep policy part of the State Department. And prior to that, was dean of the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. Now, I first knew Anne Marie when she was at Harvard Law School doing research on a networked world, which she was predicting and trying to help us understand back in the 1990s. And so I'm going to, and you probably all know Anne Marie, not just for her foreign policy chops and international law chops, but for the work she has done on the role of women and that seminal article that argued that women can't quite have it all. So that led
can,
to book.
But just not yet.
Yeah, don't have it all. That's right. So I'm going to ask you just to set the table before we get into what will face the president. Give us a sense of what the international order looked like 70 years ago. It was being built by Western leaders. How that might be changing, you know, what remains the same, but how that might need to change to adapt to a very different world.
Great. So I think this is a fascinating moment in terms of how the global system is changing. So if you go back to 1947, you have what I call a chessboard. You have the world of governments, what I think of as Henry Kissinger's world, the world of statecraft, where it is essentially, there are a certain number of nations in the world. There were 50-odd in 1945. They're 200-odd now. But if you look at the states that we think about most in the State Department, you're probably still at about 50 states that you really have to constantly pay attention to. And international relations is a question of, I'm a government. If I do this, that government will do that, and I need to anticipate that. That's chess or poker. There are other games, but it's essentially statecraft. When we think about it, we generally talk about some kind of game. That world is not going away. I do not believe that the state is withering away. I do think cities are becoming much more important. I'll talk about that. But it is very hard for me to imagine any other way of organizing 7 billion people than states, however imperfect they may be. So I don't think states are going away, and I don't think statecraft is going away. That next president, she's got China, Russia. Okay, now is the time for me to say New America is nonpartisan. We have Republicans and Democrats chairing our board, so that was a personal slip. Anyway, the next president will face China, Russia, Iran, still has to think very much in terms of statecraft. But here's what's happening and is going to grow increasingly. We also, the world is a chessboard, but it's also a web. So it is that world of states. But now just think about the internet, or think about a map of the world at night, right? With all the lights and the networks, or think about a digital map of the world. That's a world of networks. And that world has been steadily rising. And yes, I started working on government-to-government networks in 1994. But it is now at a point where if you are a business leader, a nonprofit leader, a university leader, anyone who is active in something that is global, and increasingly that can be very small businesses, not just big businesses, and small nonprofits, not just big nonprofits, you are part of the web of global relations. So going forward, and I will say I have a book coming out called The Chessboard and the Web, but if you are a member of the web, you are equally important now to solving global problems. If you look at the Paris Agreement, you got lots of governments, but for the first time, you have what the Paris governments called non-party stakeholders. That meant the 7,000 cities around the world who've made commitments to reduce their emissions. That meant thousands of businesses who are part of those commitments, and thousands of NGOs who are monitoring those commitments. And for the first time, they have a formal status in the Paris Agreement. So going forward, you're going to have statecraft and webcraft. You're going to be building strategic networks and figuring out how to run them and how to tap their capacity and how to combine them with governments. And you're going to need both to face the problems we face.
Now, when you think about the factors that are driving this change, technology, the demographic change, to what degree are those same trends shaping our politics today and contributing to some of the divisions we're seeing? Are we in a sort of transitional phase? Say something about the connection between that analysis and what the president, what this campaign has felt like. What's been the deal during it?
So I do think there's some profound similarities. And I just should have added, the web groups who have figured out how to make networks, they're the criminals, right? We're accustomed to terrorist networks, money laundering networks, arms trafficking networks, human trafficking networks. They've got this. It's up to us to figure out how to build the counter networks. But here's where I think there's a similarity. The empowerment of all those web actors is a function of digital technology and globalization more generally, right? It is now possible, if you think about ISIL, or frankly, if you think about an NGO who wants to network with its counterparts, you create a web platform, and suddenly, as we keep reading, individuals, whether they're in Egypt or the United States or China, have enormous agency, right? That's the term we use, right? The increase in the ability of any individual to make a difference in the world. Thomas Friedman wrote about the super empowered individual in the Lexus and the Olive Tree in around 2000, and it's just gotten stronger since. But we haven't yet figured out how to make that individual a part of something positive and meaningful and with impact. And so if you connect that to national politics, that's a lot of what you're seeing. A lot of individuals who are really angry and who have now the ability to make themselves heard and to find each other and to connect with each other. What we haven't done as a national government on the right and the left, because remember, we're looking at Donald Trump now, but a lot Bernie Sanders supporters were as angry in many ways with the Democratic establishment as Donald Trump's supporters are with the Republican establishment. So on both sides, you've got people who have the agency to be angry and voice their dissatisfaction, but don't yet have the structures to turn that anger into positive action.
So as the next president faces a big challenge, a bit of a crisis of legitimacy, part of the voting public, maybe a large part of the voting public, will see that president as either illegitimate or unfit.
Yes. Right?
In order to kind of regain the trust of the American people, won't it be important to get stuff done in certain areas quickly. And I can't help but think about an area that surely has bipartisan interest, and that's the jobs challenge. Can you talk a little bit about how the nature of work is changing and will change, in part as a result of technology, and then we'll move on to trade?
Yep. These questions are just sort of a rundown of exactly why the next president is going to have, I won't say an impossible job, but an extremely difficult one. So I think a large part of what you're seeing in terms of the division in the country is exactly this, yeah, it's all talk, right? That's what Donald Trump keeps saying to Secretary Clinton, right? It's all talk. Sounds good, no action. And we have large parts of this country who've been hearing talk for a long time, back to the 70s, right? But their standard of living is going down as they watch other people's go up. And you know, now they've got both, you know, men and women working, right? They've held level because their wives have gone to work, but they're barely holding on. So she's got to do, or he has to do something that is really demonstrates action. I think the first thing you will see is a large infrastructure projects. And again, I mean, this is actually where I wish earmarks were back. You know, earmarks did us a lot of good, right? How did you constitute a coalition? You went to individual members of the House and the Senate and said, okay, this bridge will be built, you know, in your district. And there's a whole body of literature that says that's a problem. But I do think, just given the state of our infrastructure, and I live on Amtrak, this is not a recipe for happiness, I have to tell you. I mean, it breaks down constantly. It's constantly late. It doesn't break down because of snow. It breaks down because it's cold. You can kind of anticipate cold every year, really. And I sit there, and I'm not sure what I'm more unhappy about, the state of our infrastructure or the seeming acceptance of my fellow passengers compared to the Europeans, the Japanese, the Chinese. But I do think there is a way to stitch together major work on infrastructure. And then I think, you know, the biggest question we all face, and again, this from right to left, is in the digital revolution, we're at the equivalent of 1830 in the Industrial Revolution. So by 1830, the steam engine had been discovered, you had railroads, but it was just the beginning, and steamboats, just a few though, if you actually go back. By 1890, the United States, Western Europe, were unrecognizable, right? So you had all the steam, then you have electricity, and of course then later the internal combustion engine. We're just at the beginning. We've seen what digital technology can do for the information industry. We haven't touched it for transport, for agriculture, for the more traditional sectors of the economy. And the great question we're all facing, and New America and Bloomberg Beta are actually looking at the future of work, workers, and technology, some people predict 9% of jobs will be automated. Other people predict 41% of jobs will be automated, and those are white-collar jobs. Those are jobs that we studied for, like litigation. I was a law professor for many years. A huge amount of what lawyers do now can be done by machine learning. Or we're already seeing that in medicine, and then all accounting, all routine jobs that require intelligence and training, but are relatively routine. So we have to start thinking now, okay, what's the social safety net look like for that world? And that's, again, where you've got libertarians and technologists worrying about that because they know that you can't sustain a society with this degree of inequality. So maybe we end up with universal basic income, or maybe we end up with a very different social safety net than we have now. But that's something where the next president can't answer those questions. But I would appoint a national commission. I'd have Republicans and Democrats, technologists and others, union leaders, really thinking through, all right, what are the policies we have to put in place that would be relevant to whatever scenario? Because we can't predict, but we can say we are in for the same kind of change we were in 1830. And just last thing, remember, the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century, that brought us Marxism, right? That upheaval, that's where Marxism came from. And then from Marxism to fascism. So these kinds of social disruptions turn into economic disruptions, turn into political disruptions.
So as you think about that, you touched on the role of technology in driving this and what are the risks politically and socially. What does this mean for the next president's approach to trade? TPP has been criticized by both candidates.
So let me start by saying, I do not think Secretary Clinton's change on TPP was as opportunistic as many people paint it, for the following reason. When I was in the State Department, I was completely for TPP. I mean, if you were looking at our policy toward Asia, we don't have that many cards, and you've got a lot of countries in Asia that are very worried about China, but they're also worried about the United States getting too aggressive toward China. So Lee Kuan Yew, when he was still alive, was, we want you here, but we don't want you here rattling sabers, because that's going to create dynamics we don't want. So in that world, what have we got? Well, trade was a huge piece of what we had. I was totally supportive of TPP, and so was Secretary Clinton. When I left the administration and went back to Princeton and then went to New America, I looked at my tech people. I looked at my economic policy people. A lot of them were very skeptical. And they were skeptical not because of an overall stance on free trade, but because they really questioned whether this agreement was as inclusive as it needs to be. So just to start, I really do think she actually, once she started campaigning, started looking at this from a different point of view. More broadly, and I understand that what I'm about to say is heresy in the church of free trade in which I grew up, I really do think we have to have a new conversation about trade. I am all for free trade in theory. I know about Ricardo. I get the expanded pie. But all of that assumes you redistribute enough to preserve a political consensus for free trade. And we do not have that. And we cannot keep saying, and here I'll say as a Democrat, it is just not good enough to say, well, we'll elevate labor standards and environmental standards and we'll retrain you. You have people all over this country saying, forget that. Retraining doesn't work. We are the losers, and we're steadily the losers. And the people who are capturing the gains from trade are too small a slice of our society. So we need to have a real national conversation, again, right and left. And you got people on the right and people on the left who are saying, this is not good enough. And, you know, there are times economic models work in theory, but they don't work in practice, and we have to turn to something that is fairer trade. And again, I don't want to, you know, we don't want to go back to tariffs, we don't want to go back to mercantilism, I get that. But unless we have a trading system that does what John Ruggie once called embedded liberalism, meaning you embed economic and social protections domestically, and that's what supports free trade, unless we have that, we're not going to get free trade agreements, and frankly, I'm not sure we should.
So let's go to Libya for a moment, because there's a place where Russia acquiesced to the to the approach that NATO took, and it is an example of responsibility to protect, but that morphed quickly into regime change. Yep. What are the lessons of Libya, not for us, but for Putin? What lessons did he draw?
So I'm thinking, if I were Susan Rice, I would now give you 20 minutes on how Putin knew exactly what he was getting into in Libya. She has no patience with the idea that the Russians didn't understand what they were agreeing to. But to be fair to Putin, although I do support responsibility to protect, and I interpret that, though, again, as a strategic doctrine that says in a completely interconnected web world, we can't afford to let governments massacre their own citizens. It's not a humanitarian position, it's a strategic position. It says the consequences of letting governments do that are profoundly dangerous, and we globally have got to intervene earlier rather than later because we will suffer, not just because those people are suffering. But I think Libya was not well done, right? And I would also argue, and a number of states have argued that you can't intervene to stop a government from massacring its own people if that's going to mean the overthrow of that government. And in Libya, Gaddafi was just going to keep massacring people, and so very quickly it turned into we're going after Gaddafi. You can't do that unless you've got forces for the day after. Because, and we didn't. And actually, I've just finished Alter Egos by Mark Landler on Secretary Clinton and Obama. And, you know, people said, wait a minute, we're going to need forces for the day after. And neither the Europeans nor we were interested in providing those. So to be fair to Putin, you can say, wait a minute, overturning Gaddafi and creating an entire country that where ISIL or Al-Qaeda can root and that also destabilizes Mali and the rest of northern Africa, that wasn't a good idea. That's fair to Putin. What is not fair is to say that means that we should simply ignore a government that is determined to do anything necessary to stay in power. And just to go back, the earliest example of this is Hitler, right? Human rights was born in part understanding that had we paid attention around Kristallnacht, we wouldn't necessarily have gotten all the way to 1945. That that was a government that was willing to do whatever it took to get to power and stay in power, and that we had those early warning signs. And ultimately, of course, that led to world war. What we're looking at now in a Rwanda or a Syria is the destabilization of an entire region, and then, of course, terrorist networks, refugee streams, other things that imperil all of us.
Speaking of the day after, we're watching Mosul play out in Iraq, and then, of course, there'll be Raqqa, presumably. If you assume that, as certainly I do, that the coalition forces backed by American air power will prevail in both of those cities, then what? Won't the same sectarian divide that allowed those cities to fall to ISIS still be there?
Yeah. Let me give you the realistic short-term answer, and then since we are at the 70th anniversary, I'll project what I'd like to see 70, or what I would actually predict 70 years hence. So right now, we can destroy the territorial caliphate. And that is what we're doing, right? We can drive ISIL out of Mosul, then Raqqa. We've already driven them out of Dabiq. Dabiq is an extremely strategic city for them because that's where the apocalypse is supposed to happen. Their magazine is called Dabiq. And we can drive them out of those cities. They're already telling their followers, well, you know, this territory is not so as important as we said it is. You know, the caliphate is virtual. They're already preparing for that next phase. What we can't do is actually provide good government in those areas. We're addressing the symptoms, not the cause. Right? We cannot create either in Mosul or Raqqa or more in Iraq more broadly or in Syria more broadly or in Saudi Arabia. We can't create the kinds of governments that are allowing millions of young people opportunity and a future and a decently governed country, whether it's a democracy or not. So what we're going to do is this is a battle. It's not the war. This is tactical, right? So we drive them out, but we know they're going to come back. Well, they'll either come back into those same cities, as has happened, or the Iraqis and the Syrians and the Kurds will hold those cities and they'll regroup in other places. Long term, the only way to actually be able to act effectively, because we have learned that sending US troops or European troops or any foreign troops doesn't work, right? It doesn't work. We're not going to do that again. But really, if you look back 70 years, the UN expected to have a global army, right? In 1945, in the UN Charter, there's a whole provision for a global army. Well, that didn't work, right? Nations quickly said, no, we're not going to do that. We'll send peacekeepers, but we're not going to have a global army. Looking forward, we need, and it probably will be national and then you accumulate it at global forces that are combined of some military, a lot of police, constabulary forces, development people, and political people. You need integrated forces that can actually, and under a global lens, not US forces, but you'll have national versions of this, where you can go into a place like Raqqa and you can actually say, and again, you're global, so you can't say this is the West, you can then start to build the foundations of security and economic development that we know how to do, but takes a long time and can't be done without basic security. So I think that's where, longer term, we're going to have to go to be able to handle these kinds of situations.
Now, two of the questioners who sent up cards have brought up another transnational danger with which to deal, and that's climate change.
Yes.
Donald Trump has said one of his first acts in office will be to sign an executive order pulling us out of the Paris Accord. Presumably, Secretary Clinton would like to stay in. What will it take, if we do stay in, what would it take to meet the obligations under that accord by way of technology investment and other things? And then secondly, what would be the impact of withdrawing?
So this is, again, where thinking about the web world is so interesting. Because let's assume Donald Trump did do that, and he pulled us out of the Paris Agreement. Cities representing 80% of the world's population and an enormous percentage of the global GDP, it's again somewhere between 70 and 80%, have signed on. So he can pull out New York, Chicago, San Francisco, LA, all those cities are still going to make carbon commitments to cut carbon, and those commitments will be part of the Paris Agreement because they're cities and they need to, and the Chinese cities too. So then what will happen is there'll be a suit brought to the Supreme Court that says the executive has the foreign affairs power. Can the executive prohibit cities from doing something that is in their interest? It's not legally binding. It's not legally binding in international law. That they can't do. But can they do it as the power of a mayor on the global stage? And it's going to be really hard. We don't know what the Supreme Court will look like. But I think it's going to be very hard for a Supreme Court to say no, because how else can mayors, and again, Republican mayors as well as Democrat mayors, actually do what they need to do to improve life for their citizens. So this is an example of where, you know, sure, on the chessboard he can pull out, but I don't think he can actually stop the agreement from taking hold.
So climate change is an issue, or addressing it is an issue that isn't just about states, right?
Not at all.
It'll be about business, it will be about people.
Mayors, NGOs, sub-state and non-state.
Yeah, and so I'd argue that cybersecurity is another case in point. There's a place where technology has gotten out ahead of social innovation. We don't yet have a regime for or a set of rules of the road. Talk a little bit about the need for the president to address that issue, but also who else has to be at the table, both for developing the norms, but also for execution.
Exactly. This is what's called a foreign affairs workout. We're going right across the range of issues. So cybersecurity is exactly, again, it's an intergovernmental issue and it's a web issue. So intergovernmentally, think about the North Korean hack of Sony, right? That was effectively an act of aggression by one state against another. And although Sony was hit, the US government responded. I don't know the details of how they responded. They don't want us to know the details of how they responded, but I know we responded. And there was actually something reported about a couple months later, something going on in North Korea. I know we made it really clear to the North Koreans, you do that again and we'll shut down every system you have. So, and similarly, right now, you know, our attack, Stuxnet on Iran, that was an attack by Israel and the United States on Iran. So you have those kinds of issues that are really intergovernmental. But then you have, how do we protect the American people against manipulation with our voting, against the possibility that, you know, somebody scrambles our banks, against the possibility that people take down our grid? That can't be handled just government to government. You can try to deter, but fundamentally that's a matter of security in the sense of resilience, in the sense of protection. And to do that, the government, again, has to plug into vast networks of corporate leaders, of universities, of hospitals, you know, of electricity, of power companies. You know, think about all the different pieces, and we have to be able to mobilize those networks, but also give them the means they need, but also draw on what they have, right? Apple's got better encryption probably than the NSA, or at least it's probably neck and neck. And so we have to, again, combine those state actors with those web actors in ways that really is a different kind of foreign policy. It's a kind of foreign policy that in 1945, you just didn't have to think about convening all those actors or using them in systematically.
So these problems that require us all also require our coming to a shared view of who we are, and what we stand for. And you started by describing a world very much changed by technology and demography. What does that mean about coming to grips with who we are?
So again, if I said in the Industrial Revolution, we're at about, in the Digital Revolution, we're at the equivalent of 1830 in the Industrial Revolution. That's an enormous change. But equally, as Eric Liu, who runs the Civic Collaboratory, has written, he wrote this great article on democracy where he said, being American is slowly, agonizingly, but inexorably being decoupled from being white. That means by 2050, for the first time since 1600, or whatever you want to date the Americas as the without Native Americans, which is not fair, but the political America. For those 400 years, longer, to be American has meant to be white, and anybody who's not white gets a hyphen. Well, by 2050, I'll be a European American. When the world looks at what an American is, it will be somebody of color. That is an enormous transformation. It's an enormous transformation for us, and we're used to massive transformations. That's not going to happen quite as fast in Europe, but it's happening in Europe too. I'm half Belgian. The Belgium I grew up in was all white, and the Brussels I go to today is definitely not. Look at London, Landon Heathrow. Look at who is admitting you in Heathrow. So these are massive demographic shifts. And it's impossible to imagine that they don't create the kind of anger and dislocation we see. And indeed, again, in the 19th century, we had huge anti-immigrant movements, and they were against Russian and German and Irish immigrants, right? And whom we didn't count as white. So we're in for a bumpy road. But I am optimistic because, you know, I wrote a book in 2007 called The Idea That Is America, Keeping Faith with Our Values in a Dangerous World. And what I said, and I was born in Charlottesville, like it doesn't get more American history than that. Mr. Jefferson strides the streets. You're expecting to see him at any moment. I mean, you really are steeped in it. And, you know, Virginia thinks it invented this country. So, but I look at that and I say what makes America America is not that we're better than other people. It's that we have a set of values that hold us together, because that's all we've got. We've got the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and the Gettysburg Address and I Have a Dream. We have these documents. We don't have race. We don't have shared history. We don't have ethnicity or religion. What we have is that we constantly fall short of those values, but then the system is constructed so that we have room for people to stand up, like African Americans today, like women, like Native Americans, whoever it is, to say, hey, you said we're supposed to be equal. We're not. And then we have to respond. And I am enormously proud to think that I live in a country that will reflect the world. And I'm enormously proud when I look at the Olympic teams and I say, look at us. We look like Africa. We look like East Asia. We look like South Asia. We look like Latin America. That is a country that you can be proud of. And I think it's going to be really hard to get there and lots of upheaval, but I am confident we will. Thank you.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council, sponsored by Chevron. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We just heard from Anne Marie Slaughter, President and CEO of New America. She served in the State Department as Director of Policy Planning. Up next, we'll be hearing from former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson. Secretary Paulson is chairman of the Paulson Institute. He will be sharing his views on the global economy with a particular emphasis on the relationship between the U.S. and China. He'll be in conversation with Anya Manuel. She's co-founder and managing partner of Rice Hadley Gates. This event was recorded in San Francisco as part of the World Affairs Annual Conference. World Affairs is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. And now, back to our moderator, Anya Manuel.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to our keynote session on the global economy and the key question that has been so much on everyone's mind in this election, which is China. We're very pleased to have with us today Hank Paulson, who needs no introduction. He was George Bush's Secretary of the Treasury from 2006 to 2009. Not an easy time to hold that position. He was formerly the CEO of Goldman Sachs, and he now runs the Paulson Institute in Chicago. And as a native Chicagoan, he has a very important appointment tonight with the Chicago Cubs. So we're gonna try to get him out of here on time. So Hank, let me start with the Chinese economy. You were there all the time, you were there last week. Is it turning a corner? Are they making the reforms they need to? And if not, what further reforms are needed?
Well, Anya, to begin with, anybody who thinks that China has developed a better form of capitalism is misinformed. So, you know, I always say you can make as big a mistake, overestimating China's strength as you can underestimating its potential. And right now, they've got some significant economic issues they're struggling with. Short, intermediate, and long term. I think short term, they're dealing with really high levels of overcapacity in a number of industries like steel and coal. An economy that's slowing, and they're managing currency issues. Intermediate term, they've got debt at the subnational level, and these tens of thousands of inefficient SOEs and municipal debt growing much faster than the economy. That's not sustainable. And of course, longer term, they need a new earnings model. That they're too reliant on exports and government investment in infrastructure and so on. They need more reliance on this, developing a services industry, consumption, higher value-added manufacturing. And so I'd say if there is good news, it is that the answer to all three of these is really accelerating the reforms that Xi Jinping has laid out. And although they've made progress, the most important and difficult ones have been slow in coming, and this is reforming the state-owned enterprises, breaking up the oligopolies, putting them on a level playing field, and making room for the private sector in certain industries like telecom and finance and energy, where the new jobs have got to come from. And you say, why haven't they made as much progress there? There are strong vested interests, and so I think people are going to look and see that the first 5 years of Xi Jinping have been focused on the political issues, on the party. If you're an optimist, you look at the next 5 years as taking on some of these really difficult structural economic issues. And I believe it's, first of all, it's not an easy to reboot an $11 trillion economy. Even under the best of circumstances, there's no playbooks, and there's going to be problems. China's size and importance in the global economy means it's going to get a lot of scrutiny. There's going to be volatility. And I think under the best set of circumstances, we're going to see bouts of volatility, fits and starts as this economy gets to a sustainable growth level, which still could be well above the developing world. And so I think I'll leave it at that. I think there's a lot of uncertainty, and the key is going to be the ability of this government to deal with the most difficult structural economic issues.
Thank you. Now, there's of course been lots and lots of talk in our presidential election about China.
Right.
And about our own economic imbalance with China. Huge trade deficit. There's a lot of talk about currency, even though that's mostly actually over now.
It's just the opposite. They've been actually propping up their currency when we talk about them manipulating it and driving it down. But anyway, go on.
That's right, exactly. How do you see that imbalance, or trade imbalance for starters, as a big problem? And second, what do you think our levers are? What leverage do we have to correct this?
Well, first of all, I think our trade with China is an enormous benefit to China and to us. You know, trade benefits the United States of America. China has been our fastest growing export market. It's our second largest export market. We have a trade deficit with China, but with the rest of the world. And that's really more about the United States of America and the fact that we save too little and borrow too much. But the levers we have, I think the important lever we have to continue opening up areas of their economy is the bilateral investment trade negotiations which are going on. Because I think the Chinese have traditionally used trade negotiations, investment negotiations, the legendary Premier Zhu Rongji used the WTO negotiations to drive reform and opening up in the Chinese economy. But I think it's going to be a real challenge. I think it's these economic linkages, trade and investment, which benefit both of our countries, they're under fire. You know, protectionism, isolationism, nationalism, and it's going to be difficult to keep that momentum going. But it's going to be very important to do so.
Can I press you a little bit on the bilateral investment treaty? Because right. We have a group here of business leaders, right. Folks who probably do a lot of work directly with China, people who are experts on foreign affairs. Where do you think it stands, and what specifically would you like to see in it that would be wins for the United States?
Okay, well, let me, because we probably got people here, you know, that some are experts and some aren't. The United States is basically an open economy in terms of investment. So that means the presumption is most sectors are open. We have a very small negative list of precluded industries, you know, utilities, defense. And then we have a national security law which limits investment in areas where there's a risk to national security. China is the opposite of that. It's closed unless you negotiate a deal. So the big breakthrough was China had agreed to enter into a negotiation where they were going to define a negative list of industries that were precluded from investment with the rest being open. And so that was a big breakthrough. And so both sides have been working to negotiate a high standards bilateral investment treaty. And the benefit to the Chinese coming out of that would be that this would help drive reform. Because basically, it's going to be a huge benefit to them to have competition and open up certain sectors to competition. And obviously, it helps the US side on their investment. And what I would say is, I wish there had been more progress, but there's been a lot recently. And both sides are negotiating hard. And I think there's some chance, a reasonable chance of reaching agreement this year. But even if they don't reach agreement, the fact that so much progress has been made, I view as a positive. And I think that's about as far as I should go here.
And so you think we might reach agreement before the end of the Obama administration?
Yes, Anya, thank you. I think that this is, you know, it will be easier for the Chinese to negotiate an agreement, I think, with this administration than it will be in the foreseeable future. And I think that should be the goal, to reach an agreement.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. So.
And again, this would benefit both countries, because I argue also that Chinese investment in the U.S. that creates jobs and helps our economy is a good thing. And we've benefited enormously in our economy from foreign direct investment over the years.
That's right. Well, especially in California, there's a lot of Chinese direct investment.
There sure is.
That's right. It's the one growing area, actually, of foreign direct investment in California.
Yep. And the jobs, when you look at the data, the jobs are actually better paying jobs than the average.
That's right. So let me stay for a minute on trade.
Yeah.
It's a difficult topic. It's been much maligned by both presidential candidates in this election. We're about to go into the lame duck session of Congress where we might see TPP up for a vote, we might not. Do you think the Chinese, of course, feel a little bit left out of TPP? How do you see, first of all, do you agree that we should pass TPP? How do you see the Chinese reacting to it? And do you think there's any chance that it will be passed?
Okay, wow. So
we're doing complex questions because you have little time.
Sure. So I'm going to begin by saying the trade is an enormous benefit. That you know there have been studies like the recent Peterson study that show that you know that the average family in the United States of America has an income $10,000 higher as a result of trade since World War II. But the benefits of trade are spread all over, across the whole economy, and the dislocations are very obvious. And then a lot of the dislocations that people blame, on trade are really the result of technology and automation, which is disrupting all kinds of labor markets, or sometimes domestic competition. So I think making the case for trade, and we can talk about how you're going to do that, I think is going to be enormously important. Now let's get to TPP. TPP is, that's the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This deal is really, really important. Think about it for a minute. When we, we've got 5% of the world's population. The idea that we can sort of draw, a ring around the United States and not do business with the other 95% is crazy. If we want to be an economic leader, how can you be an economic leader if when you negotiate a deal with your allies, you can't get it done? And that's, we've had Japan make major concessions, Vietnam willing to change their constitution, Malaysia coming into a rules-based system. So to me, this is a big economic benefit because our markets are already open. The tariffs are lower than anyone else's. So this is, this is a big benefit economically. But if we can't make good on a deal we work out with our allies, this really gets to our economic security, it gets to our national security. So can we get this done during lame duck? I don't know. I don't like to put odds on it. It looks like it's going to be difficult, but it's essential. I just think it's essential. We've got to get it done. Now, how do the Chinese look at TPP? Chinese aren't part of TPP. It's a very, it's a high standards deal. I think when we get this done, and we better get it done sometime, and when we do get it done, I think the Chinese will aspire to be part of it. And bringing them into a high standards deal, I think, is again very important. I think one of the challenges of the next decade is to continue to bring Chinese into a rules-based global economic system, and they've come a long way, but there's farther to go, and so I see it as very important. And a bilateral investment treaty would mirror the investment chapter of a TPP, so that's part of the way there.
So China, of course, isn't standing still in the face of all this. They have their own trade agreement, RCEP, yeah, that they're working on.
Yeah.
It's a lot farther behind, but strangely, because of the problems that TPP is having in the United States, that has gotten a little bit of wind in its sails. Do you see that going anywhere?
Yeah, I don't. I don't. Listen, China is very active doing trade deals all around the world. And to me, trade is good. So God bless them for working to do trade deals, but we need to be a leader. So I'm much less focused. There's so much talk about what China's doing or what they're not. the focus needs to be on our issues and our economy and what we're doing and what we're doing to reform our economy and what we're doing to lead globally. What we're doing, we have to be strong economically, militarily, diplomatically. And one way to be strong economically is to do trade deals that make sense. And the TPP is a high standards trade deal. It sets new standards. It sets new environmental standards. And I'm a environmentalist. I work, most of my time is spent on conservation and environmental issues. So I go nuts when environmentalists say, we don't like TPP because it doesn't go far enough. And I say, well, what do you think you're going to have if you don't have TPP? You won't have any of this. To me, it's absolutely crazy. So again, this is a high priority, and it's not easy because it's been there's a lot of concern economically in the United States. There's a lot of disaffected people. Trade is an easy boogeyman, and it is, we saw first Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, and they've made the case against trade, and they're wrong, but it's easy to understand. And so I think one of the real challenges we're going to have is how to maintain the momentum behind trade and how to come forward with policies that can be sold to the American people.
The challenge is really how to make globalization great again.
That's right.
Exactly.
That's a great line. I'm going to use that.
Doesn't fit nicely on a hat. No. Let me zoom out a little bit because of you. Of course, you see the whole world much beyond China, and you travel a lot. As Treasury Secretary, you were involved with the whole global economy, which was in crisis in late 2008, early 2009. What keeps you up at night now? Are you worried about the global economy? Are you sanguine about it?
Well, my wife, who says I'm snoring 5 minutes after my head hits the pillow, I guess would complain that nothing keeps me awake at night. My greatest concern is this: when I look around the global economy, most major economies. Are really facing structural issues. And that means policies that worked in the past, economic policies, aren't working in the future the way they, they're not working the way they should. I would say this for Europe, clearly for China, for Japan, and for the US, for Brazil, for most places. And so you've got economic policies aren't working the way they should. The global economy is slowing down. Fundamental structural change is needed. I talked about the structural change that was needed in China. We could talk about, if we had time, what's needed in Europe, what's needed in the US, and so on. But what we're finding is the political systems, whether they're authoritarian political systems in Russia or China, or whether they're the democracies, are having trouble getting the economic policies in place because they're controversial and they're difficult, making structural change. So you see that governments are using monetary policy to try to deal with this. You have negative interest rates in Japan, in Europe, in Switzerland, and Sweden. We have very low interest rates, and so we're debating. We're all caught up in whether our interest rates should be almost zero or a bit more than almost zero, or very small. And so, what that says to me is, and debt levels are rising everywhere. So what that says to me is, when the economy slows down, we're in new territory, new economic territory, because what policy levers can political leaders and economic leaders pull? You can't pull the lower the interest rate lever, and they've got much less room on fiscal policy. So looking out a year or two, I think we're traveling into some difficult, uncharted water. And the way I look at it, these issues aren't nearly as much economic issues as they are political issues. If you got people around the table and said, what needs to be done economically, you could agree. But it's, how do you make the political systems work so that there is going to be some economic success. And of course, when you have economic problems, that then throws a monkey wrench into the political system, as we're seeing a bit during our election, which you saw with the Brexit vote and so on.
Thank you. Let me go to some questions from the audience that actually tie in very nicely to what we've been talking about. And the first question is about, you know, we've talked about the global economy. Do you think there's a chance, this comes from the audience, that there will be a bipartisan agreement to make the big structural Social Security, Medicare, entitlement reforms that we clearly need?
Well, we clearly need it. And as you know, there's nothing that's easy in Washington. Social Security is analytically simple, but politically complex. And of course, healthcare is analytically and politically complex. And we really need reform in this area, because the longer that we wait, the more costly it's going to be. We ultimately are going to need to deal with this mounting debt. I think the best likelihood to ever get reform is when you have divided government, because then each side can use the other as an excuse and can negotiate. And if you have a president who wants to work across the aisle, I think that's a hard one to take on right away. Mm-hmm. I think that the right thing to do is get some momentum and come up with maybe some easier things that can be done on a bipartisan basis, and sort of say, well, now that's one in a row. Now let's do something that's a little more difficult. But it is essential. I mean, if you say, what does our economy need? You all know it. You know, you need tax reform. We have an individual and a corporate tax system that just is a discredit to our society. We need to deal with entitlements reform. We need immigration reform. And these things haven't been done for a reason. It's because they're very, very difficult. But they need to be done. And it takes bipartisan. I've got no use for ideologues. You just need to, it takes compromise.
Thank you. And what do you think, you know all of the players in this drama personally. You know Paul Ryan, you know Hillary Clinton. You came out very famously against Donald Trump this summer. What's your prognosis that we're actually going to get rational centrist government?
Listen, I'm not a political expert. I believe I watched Hillary Clinton when she was in the Senate, and she was pragmatic. She got things done. She could work across the aisle. I watched her do it, so I believe that's her basic. I believe she'll be president, and I believe that's what she'd like to do. Now, how that gets done, because there's real pressures. You know, if it weren't for Donald Trump, the big political story would be what happened to the Democratic Party with Bernie Sanders. And so, there are real pressures on both sides working against this. But you know, you've got to be an optimist. You need to believe in our system, and I'm very hopeful. I'm a big fan of Paul Ryan, and I know he wants to get things done, and so I would be hopeful. But listen, I'm not into it. It's a lot easier to make prescriptions than predictions, and I know what they should do, but I'm not going to make a prediction. I'm just going to say I'm hopeful.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time with us, especially on a day when you're so busy. So let's all give Hank Paulson a hand of applause. Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. This program featured Anne-Marie Slaughter. She's president and CEO of New America and served as the director of policy planning in the State Department. We also heard from former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson. He was in conversation with Anne Emanuel of Rice Hadley Gates. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production has been provided by the late Maria Starr. Our recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.